Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a new federal proposal aims to protect millions of workers from the effects of extreme heat.
And how elite athletes are giving themselves an extra boost legally.
But first, there's a lot of debate about whether or not kids should have smartphones at school. Many districts around the country are beginning to ban phones at school altogether amid concerns about distraction and this disintegration of the school community. But kids' personal smartphones aren't the only kind of technology in the classroom today. Schools also give kids as young as kindergartners their own laptops or tablets, which they use for lessons, sometimes at home and in the classroom. But as the New York Times pointed out recently, parents are often concerned about the unfettered use of screens in schools, and no one seems to track it. To find out how it works here in Arizona, I got a hold of Andy Forless, superintendent of Mesa Public Schools, the largest district in the state. And she told me they approach technology as a learning tool, but it's not always that simple.
All of our students throughout Mesa Public Schools from kindergarten to 12th grade have access to a laptop during the school day. Our junior high, so our 7th to 12th graders, have what we call a one-to-one device. They have one computer that is issued to them at the beginning of the school year, and they can take it back and forth from home to school, back home, back to school. Our elementary students, they keep their computers in the classroom. And so those are more regulated by the teacher.
Okay. So do you know or have any way of tracking like how often students are on screens in the classroom, whether it's educational or not?
We could track that. That's not a data point that we pay attention to at a district level, but it is certainly a data point we know that our parents are interested in. Mm. And it's a data point that our teachers and our principals are paying attention to. Kind of the rule of thumb is the younger the child, the less amount of screen time they need.
Talk a little bit about how much this has changed in recent years. Like, I would imagine the pandemic played a big role in sort of jump-starting the role of technology and screens in classrooms because we were, you know, doing school through screens for some time, right?
Absolutely. And so we had a multi-year rollout of what we call that one-to-one initiative. Starting with our high schools, then we rolled down to our junior high students, and it would have been about 2 to 3 years before we were going to consider rolling this out to our elementary students. But the pandemic accelerated that plan, and so we worked with the city of Mesa, as well as we had to shift some of our dollars around. We also received COVID relief monies, and that allowed us to provide one laptop per elementary student. And when those go home, we also have to think about not just the laptop, but also access to safe and reliable internet.
So you mentioned earlier that something you hear a lot from parents about are you know, complaints or concerns about technology in the schools. What do those sound like? Like, what are the biggest concerns?
Much of the concern is that parents want their children interacting with one another. They want them collaborating. They want them problem solving. They want them to be exploring their curiosities in the face-to-face classroom because they know that much of the practice of the skills and content that they are learning can be done at home. And usually that's done through a device. But when they are with other typical age peers, they want them engaged.
Do you understand those concerns? Are they addressed?
Oh, absolutely understand those. And as a mom, I've got 3 adult daughters now, but I will tell you that I would have had those same feelings if that was projected to, you know, 2024 and mm-hmm. my elementary kids had access to a computer. The other thing that we have to think about is that technology is just one learning tool. It is not the learning tool. So when we'll just focus on elementary.
Yeah.
In an elementary classroom, that teacher then has to make a decision. Is that skill best taught face-to-face by the teacher? Or can that skill be taught using a computer or some type of a web application or some type of educational program that we have that perhaps is lots of repetition with immediate feedback.
Hmm.
So the teacher's decision-making has changed quite a bit with the introduction of new technologies into our classrooms.
So what are the kind of checks and balances on this kind of access to technology, especially for kids at a young age? Like, I know Mesa Public Schools is not banning cell phones in schools, as we have seen other school districts in other parts of the country and other cities around the valley do. Are there concerns about distraction, about kids just not being engaged in the class or the school community because they're on their phones?
Yes. Yes, there is a concern about the distraction caused by technology, social media, all of that lumped together. And so to be really clear around our cell phone policy is that our cell phones are not allowed in learning in our classrooms or learning spaces unless directed by the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So again, if the teacher believes that a cell phone could be valuable in the instruction for that day or for a portion of that day or a portion of a lesson, if the teacher says, take out your cell phones and I want for you to respond to a big question that I have and I want to be able to collect data in real time, so you're going to scan a QR code and send in your thoughts, that could be 3 minutes of a 52-minute lesson of mm-hmm. take out your cell phone, and then it goes right back into the backpack mm-hmm. so that it is not a distraction.
Do you have like filters, restrictions on certain sites on computers? Like, can kids get to potentially harmful content?
Yes, we have filters on all of our computers that are accessed through our network are heavily filtered.
Mm-hmm.
And we have people that are constantly looking to see where kids are going. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes a principal will contact our technology department and say, I'm worried about these maybe two or three children at my school. Can you take a look to see if they're going to places that are blocked?
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we can. I will tell you, more so in our junior highs and high schools, students who have smartphones and they are not accessing our Wi-Fi through our network, that those filters are not turned on.
Right, when they're on their network. Kids are good about finding ways around those things, aren't they?
Fortunately, yes.
So it sounds like a lot of this is about finding a balance, like finding a balance between how much screen time is good, how to make it educational, how to balance it with, you know, interaction in real life with real students that are, you know, peers. I wonder how you find that. Like, do you feel like this is a little bit of a guessing game right now because the pandemic changed the role of technology in schools so much that you're still sort of trying to feel out how best to do this?
Oh, but I wish I could tell you that it was a perfect science. It is not a perfect science. It's a combination of, as you mentioned, a guessing game, but it's also, you have to know your context. So for example, we have what are called the Franklin Accelerated Academies. We have mm-hmm. four different Franklins throughout our district. It's very back to basics. We limit technology in those classrooms. Kids are writing in cursive. They're using a six-sided pencil. The classrooms have chalkboards in them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the use of technology at a Franklin school is going to look very different than technology use at, let's just say, our STEM academy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So instructional programming should drive the decision on when and how technology is used.
Yeah. All right. That is Dr. Andy Forless, superintendent of Mesa Public Schools. Dr. Forless, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for taking the time to talk this through. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for the invitation.
The U.S. Labor Department is taking public comment on a proposed rule the Biden administration says could protect 36 million workers nationwide from the effects of extreme heat. Under the proposal, employers would need to implement plans for rest breaks, water breaks, and shade when temperatures reach a certain threshold, among other provisions. The acting U.S. Labor Secretary, Julie Hsu, is in the Valley today to talk about this. I caught up with her yesterday and asked what, to her, are the key aspects of this proposed rule.
So let's just be clear, right? Heat is, for working people in particular, not just an inconvenience or a discomfort, right? It is actually an occupational hazard. And heat is the leading cause of death among all weather-related phenomena in the United States, more than tornadoes, hurricanes, and floods combined. Yet, there has never been a national standard that protects workers from the dangers of heat in the workplace until now. So our proposal would ensure that the threat of extreme heat doesn't kill workers, right? That no job is a death sentence, whether that's a farm worker or a letter carrier or a construction worker. But also we know that indoor heat is a problem, right? About 1 in 5 heat-related fatalities happen in indoor settings. So that could be a cook in a restaurant. It could be someone who works in a factory or a warehouse. So this standard would, when there are certain temperatures that are reached, trigger certain protections. Employers would have to make sure that workers have shade, have cool drinking water, have the ability to rest and recover. Again, very fundamental common sense things that just clarify what the standard should be. And it would require that employers put in place a heat plan so that you know, there's anticipation of what could happen and a way to avoid the something disastrous from happening before it does.
What kind of enforcement mechanism do you think these kinds of rules need to make sure that employers are following them?
Yeah, so two things, right? One is that one thing we have seen, and this is because the vast majority of employers in the country want to comply with the law. And so when we put in place a standard, that helps to shape behavior, right? That helps to lift the floor under, you know, that protects working people. But the other is we also know we have to have enforcement, right? When we don't, there are still employers who unfortunately have decided that it's cheaper to break the law, the chance of getting caught are slim, and the consequences, even if they do get caught, are minimal. So we engage in enforcement. We put every resource we have at being strategic and smart about it, right? We just do not have the capacity to investigate every single workplace, but that's okay. We also don't want to, right? If employers are playing by the rules, they're complying with the law, they shouldn't have to be investigated by the Department of Labor. But for those who are not, we focus our enforcement resources on making sure that violations are not just a cost of doing business. So we can come onto the employer's work site. We can interview the employer and the employee. Some of our work is complaint-based, but we also know that many of the most vulnerable workers don't complain. They don't know that they can complain. They may be afraid of retaliation. And so we do proactive investigations also. And then we can issue citations. We can demand that employers stop certain practices, and we can make it costly for employers who break the law.
Is it your expectation that if these rules go into effect, that certain products or services might get more expensive, for example? Like if workers who are building homes take more breaks and it maybe takes longer to build a house, might that house, for example, get more expensive? Might there be other sort of economic factors along the way as well?
I mean, no. And part of the reason for that is we are really looking at saving lives. And so one of the things that is true about all worker protections is when workers do well, employers are also more secure and our communities are stronger. The cost when there is a disruption to the work, right? Let's say, again, a worker faints on the job, a worker tragically dies on the job. That also has a cost, right? It stops the operations. From a cost perspective, we believe that many of these, the protections we put in place like this one, actually help to make sure that that we avoid the cost of doing nothing, right? And then the other part of it is that we have to keep in mind that when workers get injured, that there is a cost to that too, right? The cost in human sacrifice and human lives, and that's factored in as well.
Is this the kind of thing that is better done in your mind on a national level as opposed to a state-by-state level?
So it is both. The thing about worker protections is the federal standard is really a floor, right? The federal standard says to everybody across the country, you are protected by the federal law, regardless of where you work and where you live. This has become even more important because as we see in some states, governors have actually said to local elected leaders, mayors, city councils, counties, that they're not allowed to put in place heat protections for workers. That's just unconscionable. So we need a federal standard to make sure that there's a floor beneath which nobody should have to work and live. But of course, there are states and cities who have put in place protections higher than the federal standard. That's true of the minimum wage. That's also true here in talking about heat. And we always welcome that as well, right? Because we know that local leaders understand the needs of their communities better than anybody else, and we always support that. But once our standard becomes final, it will become the floor, meaning nobody can adopt a standard that is lower than ours.
So let me ask you about the possibility of this rule taking effect, because obviously there's a procedure that has to go through with the Federal Register and all, and that takes a little bit of time as well. We, of course, have an election coming up in November, and one way or another, there's going to be a new president in the White House come January. Is it fair to assume that depending on how that election goes, even if this rule takes effect before then, it could just go away since it's not law, it's an executive rule?
I mean, yes. So. You know, at this point, the urgency is, Phoenix saw maximum temperatures that averaged 112 degrees last month. And, you know, every day there was temperatures that reached at least 109 degrees and 2 days where it was 118 degrees. That's just in Phoenix alone, right? Across the country, we are seeing just record heat. Sometime in the last month, it was the highest temperature ever in the history of the world. So the urgency is there and the need to save lives is there. But you are absolutely right that in an administration that cares about working people, in an administration like President Biden's and Vice President Harris's, where we've said very clearly that we are going to put workers at the center of everything we do, that if we can't protect working people, if we can't build a strong economy that works for workers, then we have not built a strong economy. President Biden has been very clear, right? We are going to continue to sprint for as long as we have and do everything we can. But in a rule like this, as you noted, Mark, what happens is right now there's an open comment period. So we take comments. We expect to get a lot for a rule like this. And then we take into account those comments. We respond to them. We figure out if the rule needs to change because of them. So the process is meant to be an inclusive one in which people are heard. And so it will take some time to finalize this rule, and it will take past November to do so.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Julie Hsu, the acting U.S. Secretary of Labor. Secretary Hsu, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. You too. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a household item used for cooking, cleaning, and apparently giving athletes an edge.
But first, if your social media feeds have started filling up with pictures of jack-o'-lanterns and witches, don't worry, you didn't pass out in your chaise lounge and wake up in October. What you're seeing is a phenomenon known as Summerween. It's a movement fueled in large part by the online crafting community, where artists blend the tropes of summer, watermelon, surfboards, and sunglasses, with iconic Halloween images like vampires, graveyards, and ghosts. Summerween has been around for a while. The beloved Disney Channel show Gravity Falls aired an entire episode about it back in 2012.
Here we are, the Summerween Superstore.
Wait, summer what?
Summerween! The people of this town love Halloween so much they celebrate it twice a year. And wouldn't you know it, it's today.
Do you always carry that calendar in your pocket?
Yes.
Summerween? Something about this feels unnatural.
There's free candy.
To the costume aisle!
But this summer, it's expanded from the world of cult favorite TV shows and Instagram posts to the pages of the New York Times and the airwaves of Good Morning America.
All right, it is time now to get into the Summerween spirit. This year is all about kicking scary season off earlier than ever with fun ways to bring the Halloween vibes into summer.
Yeah, at least why not?
Yeah.
Why not?
So why now? And why here in Arizona, where Summerween has been lovingly embraced by the local craft community? Kathy Cano Murillo is a Phoenix-based craft artist, and she spoke with the show's Sam Dingman.
You know, it just kind of takes the edge off of summer a little bit to make it a little more cute and cool than what we're used to.
Yeah. This summer here, I've lived here for 4 months. Definitely not cute.
Right.
Definitely not cool. with apologies to my new state.
I also think it just, you know, allows our creativity to have fun and go wherever we want it to go. We're letting go of the rules.
And how much of that do you think, you know, since you mentioned Christmas time, there are other holidays that people love to riff on from a craft standpoint. You mentioned like bat wings on sunglasses. Uh-huh. And there are other holidays that don't move around in the calendar
uh-huh.
as much. Christmas,
yeah.
Easter. We don't really see these things remixed
right.
in quite the same way as we do Halloween. What do you attribute that to?
Well, I think Halloween is just more fun than Easter, TBH. That's my perspective anyways, because I don't see people wanting to have like an Easter pool party kind of thing. Whereas
I don't even know what that would look like.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think it's cool. A lot of people are saying enough with the pumpkin spice lattes. Like we are rewriting our own drinks and festivities that we are going to have. So, you know, you see a lot of ghost themed popsicles and the carved watermelons that look like jack-o'-lanterns. It's just so creative. I've even seen pineapples. People are carving pineapples to look like jack-o'-lanterns, and you can't do that with Easter.
Yeah. Do you think there's any element to it also that some other holidays have become kind of politicized?
Oh, yes. I have talked to many people who did not feel like decorating for 4th of July this year. And we won't go into that, but that's just how they feel. And Summerween was a great way to still express their creativity and have fun and enjoy the summer, be with family and friends, decorate and feel good about it, and take the edge off of all of the stress that is happening in the world, even for a short amount of time. It feels a little bit naughty to be working on fall projects in the summertime.
Yeah. Well, and if I may, there's something interesting to me about that Halloween seems like you can lean into that naughtiness a little bit because there's less of an overt religious valence
mm-hmm.
to it. Or like you said, with the 4th of July, it feels like you're messing with patriotism and the mm-hmm. flag. If you know, there's only so much you can do to
right.
an American flag before people start having opinions.
Right.
And I know there are some people for whom Halloween is sacred,
mm-hmm.
but it seems a little bit more culturally permissible to
yes.
mess with the tropes.
Oh, yes. And I know my husband's at home right now making little Bride of Frankenstein ladies by the pool because it's just so fun to combine these two traditions together.
As an artist, are there any traditions that you feel like are too sacred to mess with?
I think the main one for me, like with Dia de los Muertos, I like to keep that very traditional and constantly educate people that it is not Mexican Halloween. It has nothing to do with Halloween. Just constantly reminding people how they are two totally separate things.
Can you tell people who might be listening and didn't realize that Dia de los Muertos is not Mexican Halloween? Tell us what the important difference is there.
Oh, yes. Well, Dia de los Muertos, it's an ancient Mexican Aztec tradition over 3,000 years old where you honor your loved ones, your ancestors who came before you. And you build an ofrenda, you put their picture, you can write a note to them, you keep a candle burning, you have copal incense, the marigold flowers. Every single thing on that ofrenda, the offering, is to draw their spirit back on November 1st and 2nd. One day is for children and one day is for adults. And it's a time to welcome their spirits back, celebrate their life. It celebrates the cycle of life that we are all on together. We're just on different timelines of that cycle. And just remembering the things that they love to do and making them feel welcome. So it's very meaningful.
Something that feels like it's emerging for me in our conversation is this sense that there are some holidays where, and I'm generalizing here,
yes.
but there are some holidays where the goal is to connect with a tradition,
mm-hmm.
whether that's a family tradition or a tradition of an organized religion of some kind. And then there are other holidays where it feels more like we're looking to connect with a feeling.
Yeah.
And Halloween seems in particular to me like one of those holidays where it's a feeling that we want to connect with.
Right.
And maybe that gives us a little bit more leeway to express that feeling whenever and however we want to.
Yes, because Halloween is so playful. It takes us back to our childhood where we were trying to come up with a costume, wearing it to school. Maybe some of us, our moms stayed up all night sewing our costumes. That LeMay Gold rickrack was fire. And it, celebrating Halloween as an adult, it brings back those memories of how special it is, of our childhood and our families, of being a little kid. And then when we have our own kids, trying to share that magic with them.
One thing that we haven't talked about that I was, I guess, sort of expecting us to talk about is there's this thing that's happening in culture where things that we remember loving and that don't exist anymore, we want them back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want new versions of our favorite Disney movies.
Yeah.
We want reunion tours from our favorite bands from the 90s.
Yeah.
That's a big thing right now. Do you see a connection between that and Summerween, or does Summerween feel like a different kind of nostalgia to you?
I think there's a little bit of that, but I also think that we are in a time where it is exciting to find something new. And this is something new. We all want to be that person that says, look at this jack-o'-lantern I just made from a watermelon. Why did you do that in a watermelon? It's for Summerween. Haven't you heard of it? Oh, my God, I love that. Summerween. And it just goes off from there. And it's like, I heard about Summerween from Kathy. Like, really? Like, we crave that sense of newness and being the person that shares it with our friends. So I think a lot of it is just the excitement of a new category to celebrate, a new type of holiday.
I have to say there's something really interesting to me about that, because Halloween is so associated with, not to be morbid, but death, you
mm-hmm.
know, creatures
creepy,
from beyond the grave,
scary,
ghosts.
Yes,
exactly. So the idea of repositioning it to summer and allowing it to be a time of rebirth, of discovering new things, there's something kind of sweet about that.
Yes, because, I mean, I'm sure Dracula would like to sip on a smoothie by the pool on a coffin floaty. You know, like, he's like, gets tired of hanging out in October all the time. I'm sure maybe at nighttime, not in full sunlight.
All right. Well, Kathy Cano Murillo can be found online at craftychica.com. Kathy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Happy Summerween.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. If you're watching the Olympics, you know that many of these competitions are won or lost by a fraction of a second. A touch at the wall, a lean over the finish line, a tiny bit more power at the end of the race. And there are a few things elite athletes can do to give themselves that extra little push. Or at least there are a few legal things they can do. And our next guest is here to tell us about one of them that you might not expect. Baking soda. Jason Siegler is director and associate professor at ASU's College of Health Solutions, and I spoke with him more about it.
Athletes are doing things that we, us lay public, generally cannot do. And so they're really performing at an incredibly high level. And I think when you look at the margin of difference between, you know, the first place athlete and the athlete that doesn't make the podium, I think the margins are so small,
mm-hmm.
right? And so they're always looking for an advantage or an edge. And there are not very many legal edges that an athlete can look into,
mm-hmm.
especially in the nutrition side. And so there's probably three, maybe four or five legal supplements. And baking soda happens to be one of them. And so sodium bicarbonate is what it would be referred to oftentimes in the not just in the literature, but also with the athletes.
Okay.
And basically what it is when you're exercising at a really high rate, right? So you've got lots of energy demand going to the muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And what you end up doing is you're using these what are called non-oxygen pathways. And so they're very quick at replenishing your energy stores, but they also run out relatively quickly. And you can tell when they're running out because you begin to feel that burn in your muscle.
I've definitely right? felt that.
That's right.
Yeah. No fun.
Everybody has these exercises or climbed a mountain or whatever.
Yeah.
Right? And so baking soda or sodium bicarbonate basically is a supplement to the buffer that's already in your system. So your kidneys produce something called bicarbonate, and that bicarbonate is your first line of defense against that acidic burn that you're feeling, right? Okay. But the interesting thing about sodium bicarbonate is that when you supplement with it, you can actually top up your own body's stores of bicarbonate for a temporary or for a short period of time.
For a short period of time. So basically you're delaying that kind of burning sensation.
Correct. That's it.
Giving you an extra tiny edge.
That's right.
So, which makes a difference, right?
In this, absolutely. Yeah. So in the context of yourself or myself, not to judge, but we probably wouldn't notice a difference, right? But if you look at some of, in particular, certain sports, right, certain athletic events, you're talking about fractions of seconds, right? I think the 100 just recently in Paris was won by 5/1,000ths of a second.
Right? Literally a hair.
So,
yeah.
So those are the kind of margins that you're talking about gaining an advantage for.
How do you eat it? Drink it?
Yeah, so this is this has been the challenge of sodium bicarbonate supplementation over the years, right? So, and I guess I'd like to stress to the audience, it's really important to note that this is not a supplement that you would go, even though you can buy it off the shelf, you should not, and I'm certainly not advocating you do this, because what happens is if you ingest it in large quantities, like those that are recommended for performance-enhancing doses, you basically create a big change in the gas concentration in your stomach. So your stomach's very acidic, causes a big carbon dioxide shift, and then you end up with some pretty severe side effects, bloating, gastric issues that we won't get into.
So you've got to be careful with this.
Absolutely, right? And so what this has been one of the challenges with sodium bicarbonate over the years is how do we actually alleviate or how do we minimize those symptoms, right? And so this is what we started to look at, or what we've been starting to look at, and not just in the research sphere or in the lab. It's really been companies that have started to try to look at ways of bypassing this problem. Mm-hmm. And so there's a couple companies out there. Momentus does one. They have a lotion. The particular company that we've been looking at recently has developed this way of kind of encapsulating the bicarbonate. And basically what that does is just bypasses the stomach, bypasses the gut and gets it right into the intestines where it gets absorbed. So you don't have that big carbon dioxide shift, right? So you end up having very minimal symptoms, but actually gaining the benefit of having that.
So what types of athletes use this kind of thing? Like I'm thinking of runners, maybe sprinters. Is this for short distances, long distances, swimmers?
So traditionally it's been used for events that maybe last, I would say probably the shortest might be the 800 meter run, upwards to, you'll see rowers are a big user group, if you will. That's generally about 2,000 meters that they're rowing, and that's 6 minutes, 7 minutes, 5 minutes, depending on who they are. So anyway, so you kind of have that bookmark of maybe a minute and a half, 2 minutes to upwards of 6-7 minutes, and so that's traditionally been the way it's been used. We now are starting to look at using it in different contexts, right? So a marathon is a good example, right? You think of a marathon, you think endurance.
Yeah.
Which it is.
Going right? for a couple hours. Yeah.
That's right. But you're just running at the same pace in most people's mind, right? Mm-hmm. But, think of that same concept, but, during a race, you'll have periods of where there'll be breakaways, or maybe there's a hill or something like that that requires that we have to switch to that other energy source. And so when we do that switch, if we're strategic about it and we know we've got extra buffer, then potentially you can build that into your race strategy, right? So you could say, well, if there's a breakaway happening now, I can either handle that breakaway because I know I've got this extra buffer in my system, or I'm going to create that breakaway, right? Mm. Working with athletes over the past 15, 20 years, that concept is not new to them, right? Okay. So endurance cyclists I know have been using it, and those are, athletes that are on the bike for 5-6 hours. So it's certainly, it's one of those instances where you've got the athletic world or the elite athletic world trialing and error.
Have you tried it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What's it
feel
like?
This is one of the areas I've been looking at for the past, 17 years.
Wow, right? Yeah.
And when we first started doing it, we mixed up that stuff that you find on the shelf, threw in a little bit of water and had some, some flavoring, maybe a cordial in there, and and knocked it back. And,
just drinking baking soda, okay.
And so when you do that, I can tell you firsthand, your body oftentimes is not like that.
Nope.
And so you end up, dealing with those consequences.
Sure.
And I think understanding those consequences and feeling that also makes you understand that, okay, you have to get this right.
Yeah. Okay, so this is interesting because it's such a glimpse into this world of elite athletics, right? What other kinds of things out there are athletes doing at that level that might surprise the rest of us that are legal?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I guess there's a whole host of things that athletes do. And I guess this is also a challenge, right? Because you're talking about what we call in the lab N of one, right? Mm-hmm. Individual athletes. And so, you know, you have a team of athletes – or sorry, a team of support around them, right? And everybody, you know, has their expertise and what they're trying to do is figure out what exactly what might benefit that individual athlete, right? As far as, you know, these other ergogenic aids, I mean, caffeine is another one that everybody has that's
sure,
legal,
yeah.
Right? Creatine is another one. But we've seen some of the swimmers use something called – it's a bit of blood flow restriction. So there's something called ischemic preconditioning, which is, again, legal. but it's basically you're applying a blood pressure cuff more or less to a limb or two limbs in the body for a short period of time.
Hmm.
And basically what you do is you completely occlude the muscle. And just, again, for, you know, 4 to 5 minutes, right? And then you release that cuff. So when you have that big increase of blood flow, your body is also recognizing that and saying, that was a pretty stressful event.
Hmm.
I didn't have any oxygen down in that limb. And so now, potentially, I need to overcompensate and over-open, if you will, my blood vessels. And so, potentially, there's a bit of a benefit there as well.
That's
so again,
really
So that's just one.
Yeah. Okay.
One of a few.
A glimpse in. All right.
Yeah.
We'll leave it there. That is Jason Siegler, Director and Associate Professor at ASU's College of Health Solutions. Jason, thank you for coming in. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us about this. It's really interesting.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Cities around the world are working toward efficiency and, as our next guest argues, toward perfection. But René Bohr says that's coming at a price. Bohr is an architecture critic based in Amsterdam and author of the book Smooth City: Against Urban Perfection, Towards Collective Alternatives. He says the pursuit of this smoothness is taking away from what cities can naturally be or become. I spoke with him earlier about this, and we started with how exactly he defines a smooth city.
Yeah, so I understand the smooth city as an urban condition that is characterized by increasing levels of perfection, control, optimization, beautification, and especially also the eradication of everything that stands in the way of this increasing perfection, so to say. And this is something that you see in cities around the world.
I mean, this definitely kind of sounds like what urban planners strive for in many ways.
Well, exactly, yeah. And I mean, there is a paradox here. I mean, we all need cities that function well enough, that we like, that are not dangerous, that are clean enough, so to say. But I feel that in some cities, we're pushing this a little bit too far.
Yeah, so I want to ask you, because obviously your book is a bit of a criticism of this concept of the smooth city. So what do we lose? What do those kinds of places miss out on?
I would say a certain level of urbanity. So I think historically, the cities were also places where people could develop themselves, emancipate, become someone else, connect with others, build communities. And I feel that in the smooth city, the urban environment becomes increasingly this kind of environment that is only focused on consumption, that is completely scripted. So you have to follow certain pre-scripted paths in what you do during your when you go around in the city. And yeah, I would advocate a very, very different kind of city that is more shaped by people themselves rather than through pre-arranged scripts, so to say.
It almost sounds like you're describing kind of a homogenization of cities, that they all kind of start to look the same and function the same way and have the same stuff in them, as opposed to maybe what makes one place unique from another.
Well, exactly, because I think that's what the smooth city is doing. It's kind of compressing the complexity and diversity of the city into this one-dimensional, flattened surface that doesn't allow for the richness of the urban experience anymore. And so I think that's definitely a big problem, yeah.
Are you finding that this is happening by, and pardon the partial pun here, is it sort of smoothing out the rough edges of a city? Is that sort of what's happening to transform these cities into what you're seeing that you don't love?
Yeah, exactly. So not only the rough edges, I mean, also the rich complexity, the rich texture of every part of the city.
Well, so what's the balance then? Because I would imagine that if you ask a lot of New Yorkers, would you like to have, you know, a city like it was in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, with Times Square being what it was and much of the rest of the city being what it was? I'm guessing a lot of New Yorkers would say, hard pass, no thanks. You know, we're yeah, happier exactly. with the way it is. So, but so what's the balance then between, because it sounds like you're advocating for maybe some of that, but not all of that.
Well, exactly. So indeed, here we're back at the paradox, indeed, that I'm definitely not advocating for a city, for the unsmooth city, right? I'm not advocating for a dangerous, dirty, messy city.
Yeah.
Instead, what I describe in the book is to move beyond this binary between, let's say, the ultra smooth or the ultra unsmooth, and move towards what I call the porous city, which refers to the notion of porosity, like a sponge, for example. Mm-hmm. So like a much more open and fluent kind of urban environment, that its characteristics are more defined by everything that flows through it, the people, the ideas, the intentions, the ambitions. So a much more, let's say, collectively made kind of urban environment.
Well, so does that mean that maybe there are some parts of a city that are smoother than others, but maybe nothing quite as rough as what we imagine a rough city would be?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for example, here in Amsterdam, there are certain neighborhoods that become this completely sanitized, controlled, clean kind of environments that almost feel like a shopping mall, right? Or an interior space, or like an airport, for example, which is a far cry from, let's say, the very diverse and complex kind of urbanity that existed before, that was much more shaped by people themselves. So there's definitely certain neighborhoods that are like pushing it to the extreme, so to say.
Right. Well, so understanding that the answer to this question will probably be different based on what city you're talking about, but how do you try to achieve that? Because obviously there are all sorts of different competing pressures on cities and on the people who live in them and the people who are trying to create what they're going to be. So how do you try to achieve that balance?
I mean, it's very complicated, but I think what would be a good first step is maybe to limit this kind of obsession with perfection and control. So, for example, in the neighborhood where I live in Amsterdam, there is like this increasing amount of, let's say, control measures are being introduced, like certain things you can do or you can't do, or there is CCTV cameras everywhere. There's like this complete police control all the time. And I think to reduce that and allow the city to be itself a little bit more would already be a very good first step. But it also has to do with, let's say, more socioeconomic issues. If you provide affordable housing, for example, rather than just let the market run its course and ultimately only have like the most well-to-do in your city center. I mean, I think this diversity of the population is also very important. So, let's make sure that people can access housing, can access transport, can access the different functionalities of a city is also like a very crucial part of balancing between the or moving towards the poorest city rather than making this balance, I would say.
So might it be a matter of, for example, not tolerating trash on the street, but if there is maybe a little bit of graffiti somewhere that, you know, certain people in the community think of as art, maybe you leave that instead of painting over it. Is that kind of the balance you're talking about?
Yeah, maybe indeed. Yeah. So that would be a very, very beautiful, practical way of describing it, right? So let's not be too harsh on every kind of free expression by anybody in the city. But I mean, if things are really problematic, I mean, trash that is just out there in public space, let's clean it up, right? So I definitely agree with that. That would be striking a good balance.
What are you seeing in terms of cities either moving more toward the smooth city model or, as you're advocating, the porous city model? Like, are you seeing a trend in terms of which way some majority of cities are going?
Yeah, definitely. So I think what we see around the world is mostly an increasingly smoothening. I mean, there's this key examples of Dubai or Singapore or New York as well, like these kind of extreme smoothifications that are happening. But I feel that many smaller cities around the world, capitals, but also even like midsize or even small towns are also following this path. And I see very few examples actually of attempts at porosity. I mean, it exists, but it's, let's say the dominant course is definitely towards the smoothification. That's also why I felt that it was important to write this book and let's shed light on this, what I call a landmark shift in urban history, right? So for a very long time, cities have been in very bad shape. And I think many people agreed, rightfully so, that we need some improvements in the urban environment, that cities need to be organized better, need to function better. But I think that in many places, what we see now is that it's being pushed too far, and that we need to think about what's beyond the smooth city? Where do we go from here?
René Boer is an architecture critic based in Amsterdam and author of the book Smooth City: Against Urban Perfection, Towards Collective Alternatives.
All right, and that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. We'll be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more, including the Friday news cap and all of the political news of the week. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.